7 minutes past 12 on the Xolani Gwala show on this Thursday afternoon. Thembekile Mkgothotho in for Xolani today and tomorrow. A lot coming your way in the next hour or so. We're going to bring you all the latest from the Mogoro Commission of Inquiry. That's where Nomcobo Jiba is finally speaking and giving her side of the story about the events at the National Prosecuting Authority over the past decade or so. We're also going to take you to Cape Town later and check in on the National Armed Forces Day commemoration that's underway in Cape Town. President Cyril Ramaphosa addressing that event also in the last hour. And then we're also going to tell you about a proposal from the ANC here in Gauteng about how they think the country can be able to deal with the issue of accommodation. We've seen a number of protests at universities. I'm thinking of Wits University here. We also saw students at UKZN demonstrating, saying that they're facing a serious problem where a lot of students are leaving home to go and study, but when they arrive on campus, there is not enough accommodation. So the ANC in Gauteng saying, hang on, we have a possible solution for you. We'll tell you what that solution is at around 25 past 12 here on the Xolani Gwala show. So you do want to stay tuned for that conversation. As always, keen to hear your views, call us 011-883-0702 or 021-446-0567. You can also send us an SMS, 31702 and 31567 is how you can reach us there. You can also find us on Twitter. Our handle is at Radio 702. Welcome to the Xolani Gwala Show. I was telling you about Nomcobo Jiba a short time ago. Well, the suspended deputy head of public prosecutions has finally broken her silence, speaking up in her own defense at the Mogoro inquiry that's looking into hers and Lawrence Mugwebe's fitness to hold office. The pair have been criticized, you'll remember, over the years for their handling of issues, including the prosecution of the former crime intelligence head, Richard Mdluli. Their names have also come up in allegations of inappropriate handling of charges against former KwaZulu-Natal Hawks boss, Johan Boysen. That's in relation to the alleged Cato Manor death squad. Jiba, speaking of the inquiry in Pretoria, in fact, I'm looking at her now on one of the screens that we have here in studio. Someone who's in the room, or who was in the room until a short time ago, is EW and senior reporter Barry Bateman. He joins us now by phone from the capital. Good afternoon to you, Barry. So Nomcobo Jiba feels liberated by the inquiry and that she's a person of integrity. What else has you been saying?
Yeah, good afternoon, Thembekile. Well, it is quite dramatic. We had an opening address from Nomcobo Jiba. She's using this opportunity, she says, to finally have her say. Over the years, she's taken legal advice, and while she's been criticized in the media and on all sorts of other platforms, she has kept her silent on the advice of her legal advisor. She says she trusts people that are here to judge her and to listen to her side and all the other allegations made against her. And she's going to use this opportunity to finally speak openly about the National Prosecuting Authority. Well, after that address, she was then led through the evidence. And we started off going back to 2007, and that was her involvement in the investigation of then-prosecutor or prosecutor Fanny Nell in the Jackie Salidi matter. And she says that she was introduced to Richard Mdluli by the head of the NPA's Integrity Management Unit, and it was part of a legitimate investigation which was taking place at that time, and she had no reason not to cooperate. So she's made it that it was a very normal thing that she had to do, and there was nothing untoward it. She's also terrified that she does not know Richard Mdluli. She doesn't know him beyond the fact that he was a policeman at the time, and that she has no relationship with him. We went on to, of course, the Johan Boysen matter and the racketeering authorization that she's been criticized for. She says, based on the evidence that was presented to her, she was satisfied that there was indeed a case for him to answer to. Now, it got to the point she wanted to present evidence to the commission, but she said it was too graphic, and she asked permission whether she should be allowed to do this. She spoke about how people were brutally killed by these police officers. It wasn't clear what the graphic nature of the pictures had to do with the actual authorization of the racketeering.
Mm-hmm.
Justice Mkgothotho ultimately saying that she doesn't need to do so. But you know, the gist of it is that she believes she acted correctly and the prosecution or the racketeering charges against Boysen were legitimate.
Let's talk about the allegations against her for a moment, because in her opening remarks there, Jiba painted herself as a woman who feels let down by some of her current and former colleagues, one of them being Willie Hofmeyr, who made quite a few allegations against her when he appeared at the inquiry last week. Take us through what Willie Hofmeyr accused Jiba of and how she's addressed that particular part of the evidence we've heard, because she's even gone as far as suggesting that patriarchy and possibly racism played a role in his less than flattering view of her.
Yeah, and it wasn't just Hofmeyr, it was Breitenbach as well. And it had to do with her ascendancy to that position of acting National Director of Public Prosecutions in 2011. Hofmeyr telling this inquiry that he felt she was inexperienced, that she didn't have the skills and the expertise to hold that senior position. Well, she's saying here, firstly, she was deeply hurt by this feeling that these people had about her taking that position. And she does believe that there was this resentment towards an African woman being put into this position of authority, and somebody like Hofmeyr would have to take orders or instructions from or report to an African woman. So they're very clear suggestions of the patriarchy and racism. But, you know, on the acting, and what Hofmeyr, he went further, and he suggested that the Jiba was using the National Prosecuting Authority to settle political scores, that there was these prosecutions of people like Pravin Gordhan, Johan Boysen, Anwar Dramat, and so on. She's gone into the details of those, and she says that all the decisions were made based on the facts, and in some of them, such as the Gordhan matter, she played no role in that particular decision to prosecute because at the time she was on special leave. So she certainly feels very aggrieved. She feels betrayed. On that decision, on that feeling of betrayal, it has to do with her being prosecuted herself for that decision of authorizing racketeering against Boysen. She said she couldn't believe how the tables had turned, and this organization had turned its back on her, and she was the one being prosecuted for just doing her job, while the people who ought to have been prosecuted, Boysen et al., they were being let free.
But a lot has been said, hasn't it, Barry, from Nomcobo Jiba, Willie Hofmeyr. Yesterday we heard from Lawrence Mukwebe himself. We've also had the likes of Dennis Breitenbach. You've been on this story from the time of the first bits of allegations against Mukwebe and Jiba. Looking at the inquiry from the beginning, how much of what we've heard is based in concrete evidence, and how much of it really is people giving us a sense of what they observed or opinion?
Well, you know, I think it's obviously a mix of that, but you cannot get away from the fact that there were certain findings made in courts of law, such as the Gorman judgment in the High Court in Durban, which found against Jiba for her authorization of those racketeering charges. Now, the prosecution against her was based on Gorman's findings. So we've got that, those elements. We do have the findings against her in the High Court, for example, in the Ngluli matter. And, of course, there's the General Counsel of the Bar matter, which, while it found against her and Lawrence Mukwebe in the High Court, it was overturned at the SEA. But now we're going to the Constitutional Court. So, you know, there is a lot of, we can relate to the court findings, which are the objective findings against these individuals. But I think they've been bolstered by the personal opinions. Now, whatever Willie Hofmeyr might have thought about Jiba and Mukwebe, that in itself wouldn't carry so much of a weight. But when considered with those court findings, I think that is how this commission, or the inquiry rather, will assess the information. Of course, we haven't got to cross-examination yet. We're going to finish with Jiba today, then tomorrow we're going to get to the cross-examination of Mukwebe, and then onto the cross-examination of Jiba on Monday. And I think that's where we're really going to get to how credible their evidence is here. Their claims of acting without fear or favour and with integrity will be put to the test when they get cross-examined.
Do we expect then, Barry, that Jiba's colleagues, whom she says she felt betrayed by and undermined, will also be called back at some point to respond to what she said, or have they said their piece and it's all done now?
No, that's it. They're all done now. They won't be coming back. I mean, all the evidence has been led. Those that were called have been cross-examined as well. It's now into the last stretch. The inquiry, Mokoro has to submit her report to the president. I think it's by the 14th of next month.
All right, EWN senior reporter Barry Bateman live for us in the capital, Tshwane, this afternoon. He's watching the Mokoro Commission of Inquiry. Today we're hearing from the suspended deputy head of public prosecutions, Nomcobo Jiba, who's really come out this afternoon and tried to clear her name in the face of widespread allegations of wrongdoing that have been levelled against her and Lawrence Mukwebe. Brings us to 16 minutes past 12 on the Xolani Gwala Show, Thembekile in Thembekile Mkhototo, in fact, in for Xolani today. I'm also back with you tomorrow. The big story of the past 24 hours has been the budget, hasn't it? Because now today we're hearing that the ratings agency Moody's is saying Finance Minister Tito Mboweni's budget highlights government's limited fiscal flexibility amid a challenging economic environment. Moody's also saying that it is currently looking at where things are going to move in the country. You'll remember Moody's at the moment is the only of the only one of the ratings agencies that still has the country one notch above junk status. And we are expecting to hear some news. Earlier we were reporting on EWN that Treasury officials are due to meet with officials from the ratings agencies on the back of the delivery of the budget by Finance Minister Tito Mboweni. What will come out of that, we don't know. Mboweni also saying yesterday that his department will be dealing really with a stiff hand when it comes to issues of the wrongs that are going on at the country's state-owned enterprises. Let's get another view on this and bring in development economist Nwabisa Nondenja, who's joining us from Johannesburg. Good afternoon to you, Nwabisa, and thank you for your time. So Moody's is rather uninspired by the budget presented by Tito Mboweni yesterday. Do you share the same view?
Yeah, I do. I do, perhaps for different reasons than Moody's. I felt like the budget speech was quite conservative in really taking advantage of the state's role as a potential stimulator of growth in our country, a la, fiscal policy. So, yeah, I think I also found it lackluster, but perhaps for different reasons.
Just on the issue of the state-owned enterprises, I mean, Tito Mboweni talks tough. He says, for example, the SABC, if they were to get the money that they're looking for to keep afloat, what would happen is an official would then come in and sort of take over, really, sort of a curator who'd come in and monitor the running of the entire process. But Mboweni is not the first finance minister to talk tough on SOEs. That hasn't changed the picture much. So why should we believe that he will be the man to turn things around?
Yeah, I'm also quite skeptical as to how effective these measures will be, given the fact that there are embedded political interests, I think, that define how our state-owned enterprises run and how efficiently they run. I think that state-owned enterprises are like a very useful place that politicians are able to dole out patronage. And I think that there is a lack of political will to see that change. So I think until we see actual results, I am going to be very skeptical about any prospect of improvement or change in our state-owned enterprise.
One of the other things that stood out for me in that presentation yesterday was the 1.2 trillion rand that's been set aside for education over a three-year period. It sounds an impressive figure, but is it going to be sufficient in addressing the immediate needs when you think of issues around the higher education sector, where we've got that missing middle and poor students provision of free higher education? We've got issues around accommodation, for example. At basic education level, we're dealing with norms and standards that are still lacking. The money is there, but is the money going to be what fixes the problem?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that we should take note of is that things like infrastructure development, particularly social infrastructure development, is decentralized to provincial and local governments. So the Treasury can ring-fence a certain amount of funds. But as far as implementation is concerned, a large part of that is the ambit and the responsibility of provincial and local governments. And unfortunately, that is where we see much of the corruption, the mismanagement of funds, etc. So that represents a massive limitation as to how effectively or how quickly we can see the infrastructure and the conditions of basic education change. For example, the budget allocated 2.8 billion to address the infrastructure backlog and to replace paper trees in our nation's schools, right? And of course, that is a much needed intervention given the loss of life that we've seen from children falling into toilets, etc. But just to give you perspective on the level of corruption and graft at local government level, the UK's in the Eastern Cape, there was a reported 1.6 billion rand siphoned off, and that basically disappeared from these deep funds were actually earmarked towards social infrastructure development, etc. I mean, so 1.6 billion is almost half, or more than half, of this 2.8 billion that Treasury has allocated towards the eradication of people retreat. And so that gives you perspective of the level of corruption that we see. So as far as spend on basic education and higher education is concerned, one of the things that Treasury has to place as a central point of strategy is to really control and stop corruption, particularly at provincial and local government levels.
Okay, just on corruption, I mean, when you mention widespread corruption in government systems, one of the things that comes to mind is another announcement made yesterday of our help to buy subsidy, which would see government assisting first-time buyers in acquiring housing. It'll be piloted over 3 years at a cost of 950 billion rand. It raises another question of whether government has the capacity to do this properly, given the already stressful delays in our housing system, as well as the corruption that's riddled that process.
Yeah. And, you know, like, it's not just with regard to housing, we don't just see corruption within the state bureaucracy. We also see, you know, opportunistic behavior from private sector development as far as the development of social housing, etc. So yeah, it is quite a pervasive problem that I think stems or is largely rooted in a weak state that has weak oversight and weak institutions. So I think that in making sure or ensuring that these funds actually go towards their stated purpose, that is increasing access to housing for our people, the government really, really needs to look at really starting from the basics and ensuring that this rollout of infrastructure is definitely ring-fenced or protected from rent-seeking, from corruption, etc. And how that happens is to build in mechanisms for accountability for our government officials, mechanisms of transparency. The allocation of these funds must be as transparent as possible and must include public participation as far as we can ensure it. I think that the level of transparency and the level of openness will go a long way in ensuring that these types of funds are kind of protected from opportunistic individuals.
Fantastic. Nobi Sonondenja, we could talk about these issues all day. Thank you so much for giving us your time this afternoon. Nobisa brings us to 25 minutes past 12. If you want to share your views, your reaction to the finance minister's budget, Ditombweni, yesterday, give us a ring, 011-883-0702 or 021-446-0567. And you're listening to the Xolani Gwala show on 702 in Cape Talk. We're making our way to the news headlines, Eyewitness News at 12:30. Ayanda and Mark will bring you an update on the news and the sport. But we also want to take your views on the finance minister's budget presentation yesterday. What did you like? What did you not like? What impressed you most? And do you think that the plan that he has presented is enough to get us out of the rut that we're currently in, especially when you look at the problems around state-owned enterprises, as well as the crisis still in the education sector? We know first the issue is around the payment of fees. Now we're dealing with an accommodation crisis at various universities. And Ismail is on the line to speak to us from Cape Town. Hi there, Ismail.
Hello.
You want to speak about relief for pensioners in the budget?
Yes, man. Because of the increase in the fuel and food prices, it's going to affect our lives drastically.
Are you on the government pension system as well?
That's right.
I mean, a lot of people have said that, you know, the increase announced yesterday, it's just under 5%, is not enough for you guys, given just how tough times are economically. How have you been getting by?
Sorry?
I'm asking how you have been getting by, Ismail, on the government pension, given that it's so little and times are so tough economically. How are you surviving?
Man, I can only just about manage to survive after just purchasing basic foodstuffs and paying the basic commodities that I use.
And what do you think would be a sufficient amount in the pension, Ismail?
At least a 10 to 15% increase.
Mm-hmm. So in the times that you do run out of finances, what do you do then? Do you have to borrow from family and friends?
Yes, I have to borrow from family.
All right. That's Ismail from Cape Town. He's worried about the pretty low, I suppose, increase in the social grant benefits for pensioners in particular, just under 5% announced by the finance minister yesterday. And you are live on the Xolani Gwala Show on 702 in Cape Talk. You've heard there in my chat with Mark that breakdancing is under consideration for inclusion at the Olympic Games in Paris in 2024, I believe it is, or 2034, yes, I think that's when it is. Let me know if you are in support of this or against, and if you've already started setting up a team, that is even better. We're also watching a number of stories on the go at the moment. We're looking at pictures out of Cape Town where the National Armed Forces Day commemoration is underway. The big one today, though, is the Deputy Prosecution's boss, Nomcobo Jiba, taking the stand finally at the Mokgoro inquiry to defend herself. If you have any views on that, do give us a ring, 011-883-0702, or 021-446-0567. And speaking of your calls, I want to go to Henk now. He's calling in from Pretoria. And Henk, I understand you want to give us some information on a robbery at Edenvale High School.
Yes. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. What's happened?
We members of the local community chat WhatsApp group, and we got news that Edenvale High School was robbed at about 12 o'clock this afternoon. So at the current stage, the kids are on lockdown. They locked all the kids inside the high school for their safety, and shots were fired. And apparently a suspect got away, and the police are in pursuit. But in addition to that, Norcombe Park High School in Kempton Park was robbed this morning of 21,000 rand as well, apparently.
I want to go back to Edenvale for a moment. You're saying one suspect managed to get away. Are you hearing on your community group any information about the number of attackers?
The number of?
Do you have any more information about how many people robbed the school in Edenvale?
No, we don't have any further information on that. All we know is that they entered the school at about 12 o'clock and shots were fired. Of which the local security companies and SAPS responded, and one suspect got away, and he's currently, the police are in pursuit of him now, and we're following the community group to see what's going on.
And the children are in lockdown?
The children are in lockdown at school, and they advise that no one must enter the area because it's still an active crime scene.
Hank, thank you for letting us know. I'm sure Eyewitness News is following up. We're getting another call here. I see Margot is in Edenvale. She's a principal in the area and heard gunshots. Hi, Margot. What can you tell us?
Hi, Kendikile. As I was leaving school, I heard the gunshots. And as I got down towards Edenvale High, saw the security vehicles, they cordoned off the road and directed all of us into the suburb of Dower Glen. And then the community messages started coming through. The first ones were voice notes from staff at the school saying that they had been in a robbery. And now the uploaded messages on the school website are that there was an armed robbery in the reception area and all the children are in lockdown in their classrooms and that they are secure, that they are all in lockdown and that nobody has been injured on site.
Let me ask you this, Margot. Henk was telling us that another school, I think it was Norcombe Park, was also hit this morning. You're a principal in the Edenvale area. Are you guys finding that there's perhaps an increase in attacks on schools, or is this an anomaly?
Well, I think this is definitely very scary and concerning for us, and we have been talking about stepped up security, panic buttons, making sure we actually have been practicing LILOs in classrooms and evacuations for this exact reason, is that I think that sadly, schools are seen as soft targets because you have to be welcoming environments and anybody can walk in, and this is at the reception of a school. So you would be needing to welcome and greet people, and somebody then pulls out a gun and shoots at you. So, I mean, it's tragic but real.
Margot, a very worrying situation. Margot is a principal, school principal in Edenvale, where we're hearing Edenvale High was hit by robbers in the last few hours. We're going to follow up on that story and bring you the latest, hopefully with the Education Department and police. 18 minutes to 1 o'clock here on the Xolani Gwala Show on 702 and Cape Talk. We are still keeping an eye on that worrying development in Edenvale, where we're hearing Edenvale High School has been hit by robbers. We're trying to get hold of police and the education department. We'll bring you the latest update on that as and when we're able to reach them. But speaking of education, the ANC in Gauteng is suggesting the release of government-owned land and property as one of the ways in which we can tackle the crisis around accommodation at our universities. This is an interesting development, as always, in light of the recent protests over this very issue at various universities like Wits, UKZN and others. The Gauteng ANC's convener of the Subcommittee on Education and Health is Dr. Bandile Masuga. He joins us now by phone. Good afternoon to you, Dr. Masuga. How long has this been on your minds?
Good afternoon and thanks for having us, and good afternoon to the listeners. This has been on our mind for a long time. We are just saying that it's important that government in Gauteng must take charge of the crisis itself. We know that the majority of the people who come to Gauteng these days are students, are education migrants. So it's important that we create conducive space and conducive living for students to be housed in.
And this would be done, you're proposing, through a rapid land release program. How would it work in practical terms?
One of the things is that there are buildings that are owned by government, by the Department of Public Works, which are unused or underutilized. We are calling on government to release those buildings to private investors, to government agencies, to change them and renovate them and make them conducive for student accommodation. This will help in alleviating the situation. And also, if there are pieces of land that are available closer to universities which are owned by government and municipalities, they should be released for such purpose. So we are calling again that instead of us having an ad hoc type of intervention, we need a permanent department or unit within the provincial government that will deal and concentrate on student accommodation.
And how much land is available for this purpose? Do you have a figure?
We don't have a figure as yet, but we know that in Egoleni, for example, there are pieces of land that the municipality is ready to release. And we are hoping that when we get the proper audit within Gauteng, allowing the pieces of land that are closer to universities or institutions of learning, we will then be able to respond accurately on the matter.
Let's talk about the creation of this formal unit that you say would roll the program out. That would obviously cost money. How would you get around the budget requirements of that, given that even in the budget, we're hearing that there really isn't enough money for any extra spending in the country at the moment?
Yeah, we think that the other issue is to just extend other people's or other units' mandates. But we want a unit that will concentrate and focus on student accommodation. In the Premier's office or in the Department of Infrastructure Development, there could be people that are moved around the department that can form the unit, and other people can come from universities because we also need universities to be part of the unit. So it doesn't become just a government unit. It also becomes a unit that is informed by universities and the conditions at the universities and TVET colleges.
Okay, so this is a proposal at this stage. At what point would it receive perhaps serious consideration and perhaps be adopted as an actual position of the Gauteng government? What happens from now to then?
We welcome, if you have listened to the SOPA of the Premier, he actually committed to that unit. It just needs that us, for the sake of progress, that we move swiftly. And we have, as the ANC, we have actually thought that by end of March, by the end of this term, the unit will be up and running and will be dealing with the issues as they are.
All right, Dr. Bandile Masuga from the Gauteng ANC, thank you so much for your time. We took a call earlier from Ismail, a pensioner in Cape Town, who was complaining just on the back of the budget announcement that the allocation for him and others who rely on a state pension is not sufficient given the time, economic times that we all live in. And just on the back of that, a WhatsApp message actually coming in here from someone who says, why are pensioners always treated like crap? They should also get minimum wages. How many support families? So if you are a pensioner or live with a pensioner and have views on the announcement as far as social grants is concerned, give us a call, 011-883-0702 or 021-446-0567. But we're going to move on to something else that's caught my eye, and this is about new amendments which could soon do away with violent labor strikes, because under these new rules, aggrieved workers would apparently have to obtain a certificate of non-resolution before taking to the streets. They'd also have to say where they plan to picket and so on. South Africa has a long and detailed history, as you and I both know, of what have been often violent and destructive strikes. So is this the ultimate solution to that problem? To answer that question, we're joined by SAFDU's acting spokesperson, Patrick Craven. Patrick, a very good afternoon to you. So these regulations, what is your position as SAFDU?
Good afternoon. We are very much opposed to them. The right to strike is enshrined in the Constitution, so there should be no question about strikes not being allowed to take place. And we accept that there must be some basic rules to regulate. But we believe that even before these amendments, the rules were very, very strict. All sorts of procedures that had to be gone through before a strike could be declared as protected because there had been a breakdown in negotiations. So even under the existing laws, workers couldn't simply go on strike. But now even more restrictions have been placed relating to the procedures that must be gone through, bargaining, conciliation, and so on. Even worse, we think, are the changes to the rules on picketing, which we believe will make it virtually impossible for workers on strike to stand outside the premises where they work, talk to people going in who are still working. Of course, we're opposed to violence, but violence is against the law anyway. If anybody assaults somebody, you don't need a special labor law to regulate that.
But Patrick,
and we think it's just an excuse to try to make it as difficult as possible for workers to go on strike.
Okay, let me ask you this, because a lot of people who are in support of these new amendments are saying we need them because in the past we've seen these destructive and violent demonstrations, and that you as unions have often failed to be able to control your members so that when they are out on the streets demonstrating, they don't do things like damage people's vehicles and other property, for example, that they don't even damage company property. So what are you as unions, as SAFDU in particular, going to be doing better to better control that sort of situation so that we avoid a situation where, as you say, regulations are introduced that would curtail your right to strike?
Unions have always done everything possible to keep any kind of action, whether it be a strike or a march, as peaceful, orderly, and disciplined. And there's not a great deal more that can be done. So long as all these obstacles are put in place. And I think the simple answer to those people who sent you messages is that if you make it almost impossible to have a protected strike, it is far more likely to be violence, because workers will take action independently of any union. And increasingly that is happening. A number of strikes which have taken place recently, particularly of the expanded public works program workers, haven't involved any union at all. It's simply workers are so exasperated and frustrated that they simply walk out of their workplace anyway. And that will happen more and more if the unions, which are in a much better position to control and discipline strike action, are faced with such huge administrative obstacles that they cannot remain in control of the process.
Okay.
So it's really, it's self-defeating, I think, this the idea that you can somehow legislate to prevent things like violence. There are laws in place already, And in addition to that, the unions themselves have very strict rules that there must be no violence or intimidation or anything against the law on a union organized strike.
Patrick Craven, acting spokesperson for the South African Federation of Trade Unions, speaking to us about the proposed amendments to the labor laws, which would allow for a stricter management, if you will, at official level of planned protests by labor in this country. In fact, Greg in Johannesburg already standing by to respond to some of what Patrick has said. And you are not impressed, Greg, with the handling of these strikes by unions.
No, he's admitting to himself. Your question was perfect. What are you doing to stop strikes getting out of hand? He says, we're doing all we can, and they still get out of hand. So logically, the government has to step in. If he's saying, oh, we're doing this and this and this, but we could still do more, well, then the legislation isn't necessary. But the fact that he is doing all that he can, and it still gets out of hand, it means that further legislation is required to keep a strike orderly.
Greg in Johannesburg, thank you. Making our way towards 1 o'clock, you're still live on the Xolani Gwala Show with myself, Thembi Kile Mkhototo. We want to bring you an update on the story around the ANC spokesperson, Pule Mabi, his former personal assistant who accused him of sexual harassment. Now reportedly meeting with the ANC in the past 24 hours, Mabi, last week, you'll remember, was cleared of the allegations made against him by a grievance panel saying it found no evidence of sexual harassment. Let's speak to a representative for Mabe's accuser. That's Brenda Madumisha Pajibo. She joins us now on the phone. Good afternoon to you, Brenda. So this meeting that's said to have taken place yesterday, are you able to tell us what was discussed?
So the meeting was ready to conclude on between the employer and the employee. And what offer is on the table, as you would recall, the findings are that both parties must return to work. Our point of departure is that how can she return to work in the same area as Mr. Mabi? And that was our point, that it cannot be. So there has been an agreement that there will be a different deployment to ensure that that does not happen.
And I'm looking at a statement here just given to me where the woman is saying that her witnesses were meant to testify at this inquiry, 8 of them she had, but only 1 of the 8 was called. Why do you believe that was?
I mean, we raised the point to find out why that was the case, and the attitude was that, you know, she mentioned those individuals, mean that they'll all be asked to come in and testify. The panel was going to talk to some of them. If you look at a name like Nomvula Nomgonyane, it's one of those that she had requested that she must be asked to testify, and what they did was to go and talk to her. And we don't even know what she said to the panel, because her statement was never shared with anyone. Even when you read the document, it does not say what Nombola said or any other of the 3 that came, other than the 2 or 3 that Pule Mabi mentioned.
Very briefly then, Brenda, given what you've just told me and the fact that you are saying that while the woman concerned here has had to be questioned at great lengths, the perpetrator, being Pule Mabi, as you allege, has been emboldened by the outcome and gets off scot-free within the ANC. What are you going to do now to challenge the outcome from the grievance panel?
So you are aware that the victim, being Khorano, has already laid this case with the police. So it was done last year. Now we're taking this matter up and we are challenging the outcomes, because internally there's no process. They have told us that it is closed. So we'll go outside of the ANC and go to the CCMA, for an example. So that's what we're doing.
All right, Brenda Madumisa Pajibo, I do wish we had more time to talk, but thank you so much for your time this afternoon.